You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 87 is Chris Kakavas. You're right now hearing his keyboard work for the song Gravity Talks in the band Green on Red from the Gravity Talks album 1983. After playing with them through 1987, he became a leader and frontman of his own bands and has released 10 albums while still being a sideman keyboardist for Dream Syndicate, Giant Sand, a number of other acts we'll get into, and doing some other collaborations. We're going to discuss Pale Blonde Hell by Chris Kakavas and Junkyard Love from the album Pale Blonde Hell, 1994. Then Do Me No Favors from his solo album Anonymous from 1997. Then moving to Don't Think Twice from 2002's Bumbling Home from the Star. And concluding by listening to I Won't Feel Well from Love's Been Rediscontinued, his last solo album to date from 2013. He has of late been touring as a duo with my previous Nakedly Examined Music guest, Steve Wynn. For more information, check out chris-kakavas.com. For more information about this podcast, visit nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you enjoy what we're doing, please support us at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will have featured a little bit of Gravity Talks from the album Gravity Talks Green on Red 1983 to introduce folks to you. That's before sort of the classic lineup before Chuck Prophet joined, but you're very loud and featured on that. You know, I actually normally think of that band, and I would pitch Green on Red forward as a thing to kick us off because it has, you know, is known for its southwestern bluesy heavy thing that you kind of run with the Junkyard Love stuff that we're going to hear soon. That particular song has almost none of that. It just sounds like Gravity Talk, sounds like a jangly 60s thing. Your little organ could be 96 Tears. It could be one of those kind of 60s garage bands.
Yeah, that's when we were kind of making the transition from being this sort of art damage punk rock band from Tucson before we evolved into this more sort of Americana thing that was Green on Red. So I think there was still a little bit of a holdover from just a little bit experimental, a little bit more fun, not quite as singer-songwriter oriented, at least in my opinion.
That was credited to the group, whereas I know later stuff is more a couple, Dan and Chuck co-writes or things like that. Was there actual difference, evolution in the way that the composition went in that band, or did the crediting just change?
The beginning, before Chuck joined, or even after Chuck joined, it was always a pretty equal split, to my knowledge.
Okay.
In terms of songwriter royalties or songwriter credits. But later, Green on Red Part 2, you know, that was Dan and Chuck, and plus whatever session players. So that's, I guess, when they started doing the co-write thing.
But even in those intro parts, does that mean Dan brought in something and then everybody played over it and like the sound is written by everybody, so let's credit it to everybody? Or was there actual like, let's get in and write lyrics and write chords together? How did that band actually write songs?
It was mostly Dan bringing an idea or even a completely fleshed out song, and we would just add our parts. And sometimes it would be very raw, the song idea, you know. Other times, like I say, would be a little more fleshed out. But yeah, then we just add our musical contribution, maybe help a little bit with the arrangement. But it was 80% Dan as the songwriter, in my opinion.
I ask this to kind of give folks a picture of where the solo career fits in with your day job as a sought-after keyboard sideman. When I had Steve Wynn on, one of the songs we looked at, like, you were doing both the guys from the band parts in it, you know, the piano and the organ, and really doing a great job fleshing out the arrangement. Most of this solo stuff we're going to hear is more guitar-oriented. You might use yourself as that keyboardist, but like that doesn't seem, on most of the things, how the songs are written. So you parted, I see, 3 Green on Red albums and 3 EPs, so however you want to count that. And then did you jump laterally to Dream Syndicate for a couple albums, or was that going at the same time as Junkyard Love, your solo project?
I was never an official member of Dream Syndicate.
Okay.
I was more the Los Angeles go-to guy for keyboards, which was cool. I got asked by bands from San Francisco, from Davis, True West, you know, asked me to play on one of their records, on one track on one of their records. Then I ended up playing on Russ Tolman's stuff. I ended up playing on a lot of Giant Sand stuff. This is all mostly post Green on Red, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I saw Giant Sand. The earliest thing looked like 1985, so you're still doing Green on Red at that point. But I assume that was kind of a sideman, not a second band you were in simultaneously playing gigs with.
That was pretty much the case with all those bands. Okay, if there were local shows with Dream Syndicate or Giant Sand or whoever, yes, then I'd play those shows, but I never went on tour with any of them. So that's what I kind of consider what would make me an official member of this or that band.
It's 1988 when we get to the first Chris Kakavas and Junkyard Love album. It looks like we have four of those going through 95. Is that correct?
If you say so.
And we're going to hear Pale Blonde Hell, the title track from the third album of those four, 1994. This jump to being the front guy, was this a, you know, I've been playing in this thing that Dan Stewart is writing 80% of. Did you have an access of ideas that weren't being considered by the band? Like, usually when somebody makes that, I would at least hear, okay, and then on this Green on Red album, Chris sings two songs and he was the George Harrison and they were squashing him. And so he had to, you know, but there's not even any of that. No, you're just purely the sideman, and then you're purely jump out full force as this fully fleshed out thing with developed songs. So tell me about that transition before you hear this first song.
The whole time I've been kind of dabbling with the guitar, trying to learn how to play the guitar, self-taught. And suddenly I started writing songs. I wrote one song that is actually on a Green on Red record. It's actually on Gravity Talks, if I'm not mistaken. That's what you're here for. So there's that one. I actually sang that one. So that it's kind of an anomaly. It is an anomaly. I played guitar on Narcolepsy, which is also on that record. Played a 12-string guitar that I bought back in the day, an old Fender Coronado. So that's kind of where my guitar playing was ramping up to speed. When Green on Red broke up, I decided, well, let's give it a shot. Maybe I can start writing songs. And in fact, I met up with Jack Watterson, who recorded some of my first demos on a Tascam 4-track cassette recorder. And those are pretty cool. I got to see if I can find those somewhere, because those are pretty whacked out versions of some songs that I don't know if they appeared anywhere else. I can't even remember what I demoed at the time. I guess the basic thing is, it's like I never wrote songs on piano, oddly enough. I learned classical piano when I was very young. It was mandatory in our family. Every kid had to take piano lessons. I only occasionally wrote songs on the piano. For some reason, it was easier for me to write songs on the guitar. The guitar was more abstract, more unfamiliar, and it was easier for me on the guitar to step out of my comfort zone and write songs. So guitar has always been my primary instrument for writing songs.
Was white as meerschaum washed up by the sea. Her hair was as yellow as a field of blowing wheat. Her name I don't remember too well. One that I knew way back when. She reminded me of the one who taught me how to sin. She was like an angel who just fell. Thank you. is not her fault that she was the way she was. It is not my fault my heart does the things it does. Now I'm at the bottom of this well. Pale blonde, pale. Yeah, my baby left me. I got a tale to tell. So I crawled down lonely street past Heartbreak Hotel to the place where my lover dwells. Hey.
So we got an interesting mix here of a very kind of cowpoke doom, 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 tick, minor key thing. But then the Pale Blonde Hell part itself is this more wistful, almost alternative rock, slightly jazz inflected. What makes your music not fall easily into that category of country blues rock at any phase, and less so as your career goes on, seemingly, is the little extra notes in the chords that maybe that's from playing piano or your hand always falls in interesting shapes when I play acoustic or whatever. Those ninths, those 13ths, that just something to make it a little more plaintive. Can you say something about how this song came together, what you were doing musically at this point?
Before I get into the musical aspect of it, I was on tour, I believe, with Russ Tolman in Norway. And I was staying in a hotel in Oslo, and I looked out my window, and I saw this huge sign lit up. And I might be imagining part of this, but I'll describe it as I remember it. And could, in fact, the sign maybe doesn't even exist. Maybe it was a dream. There was this huge sign. It was like lit up, and it said, Pale Blonde Hell. It was advertising a beer. So it's three different ways of saying a light beer. So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's a pretty cool song title. I didn't write the song then. And about a year later, I went back and I saw that sign again, or I dreamt it again. And I was like, oh, right, I completely forgot about this. And I wrote that song from top to bottom in about half an hour. And I was pretty excited about it. I got this concept of a very traumatic relationship. Of course, as the men tend to do, you know, they blame the woman. The poor men are always the victims, huh? So yeah, I was really happy how that song came together. Musically, I know it's still in the time before I started playing in drop D tuning, which I do almost exclusively now. Or there was a turning point where I started playing only in drop D, and that led to a discovery of a whole different way to play the guitar, to play chords on the guitar, to play kind of almost like bar chords, but it still allowed me to have all these open strings in the chord, which I was always a fan of. Even at that time, as you mentioned, what you hear are a lot of open strings. I was never a big fan of bar chords. Couldn't really play them properly. That's probably the biggest reason why I never got into them. I love bands that play exclusively bar chords. I love the Ramones, don't get me wrong. Love that kind of stuff. But it wasn't my thing. It's not where I went with my guitar playing.
So just having this intro, you're starting off by yourself and then it kind of slows down and then you're starting from scratch. It brings to mind certain, it's not a breakdown because it's the beginning of the song, but it could be a banjo, certain gestures in the Southern country old style realm. I mean, do you have any idea kind of where that thematic, that dynamic gesture came from? Like where in the process would that intro come from?
I did listen to a lot of country, that's for sure, back in the day. But I also listened to Ennio Morricone. And I also listened to Neil Young.
Sure, lots of Neil Young here, yeah.
And I think all of those elements come together often in the themes of my songs. In almost any period, I think, I try and, or maybe without trying, cop some of these vibes, a combination of God knows what. But I love the cinematic aspect of Ennio Morricone and like soundtrack music. I love the rawness of Neil Young. I love the wordplay of country music. I think that's where that all kind of comes together, possibly.
Sure.
Just off the top of my head, yeah.
I like the dramatic gestures in here. So before you do the Pale Blonde Hell the first time, the guitar just sits there a little bit. Or when you subsequently do that, She Was Like an Angel Who Just Fell, and you have this big swooping background vocal, ah, and then still it sits there a little wet, and then everything comes in, which I thought the particular arrangement thing, so maybe this was a band contribution, the second time we hit the Pale Blonde Hell.
Pale Blonde.
That the second time, it keeps momentum going. It doesn't just do the sustain that you've got this ride cymbal thing. Do you remember how you make these sort of decisions in terms of, you know, we could just do the same gesture every time, but let's do something to keep it going through and like, well, what exactly should we put in there? Or just let the drummer decide.
It's very likely that either the drummer or the bass player might have mentioned something about that to just play through it. I generally bring the songs pretty completely arranged to the band, but I'm open to ideas. And I always had really great players and I trusted their playing. I trusted their ideas. Even if I brought a complete song, I generally let each member sort of find their own way with it, unless I was really feeling tyrannical.
Sure.
Because I can be a bit of a control freak, yeah. I think I'm a benevolent control freak. I don't want to shoot myself in the foot by not hearing somebody's good idea out, or at least giving it a try. So having said that, I don't know if that particular idea came from me or if it was possibly from one of my very talented band members.
Yes, I see that would be Billy Blaze Price doing drums. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
And so the next time that comes in is at the end of the guitar solo. There's not singing over it. It sounds like you're not the one playing the guitar solo, unless this is a guitar overdub, end up introducing a wah part, a wah guitar.
Yeah.
where the Pale Blonde Hell would be going. It's such a dramatic moment the first time that it's a challenge, like, oh no, that's also the hook of the song. That's not just the intro or the end of the song, you know, something we just do once. We have to do this like four or five times. And it has to somehow still work, even though it's not going to be the same epic little moment that it was the first time.
John Thoman was the main lead guitar player. I definitely played a lot of solos on that record.
Okay.
I think probably was a better solo guitarist then than I am now. Somehow I feel that way.
You play so much acoustic on so many things. I wasn't sure if you were doing any of the solos in any of the, you know, the second song we're going to hear from your Strictly Solo album. Like, there's no solos as far as the eye could see, at least in the song we're going to listen to. So I was wondering about that. But you were confident enough on guitar that you were not just being the frontman rhythm guy. You were trying to split it more or less.
Kind of, yeah. Trading off occasionally solos with John Thoman, who is one of my favorite guitar players. He's so fantastic, and he's a great steel slide player. And the great thing, what I loved about his slide playing, a lot of slide players have to retune or intentionally retune,
yeah,
to play these configurations of notes. But John just played with straight regular tuning, and sometimes he'd have to bend his hand in such a position to get to these crazy combination of notes. And live, it was always a wonder to watch. In the studio, he was very particular, and often he'd play something and he would not like it. He's like, okay, let me do it again. I'm like, okay, do it again. So sometimes we do five takes of a solo, maybe even more. Usually I'd be happy with like take three, and I'd almost have to fight, so to say, to get that take on the record or on the track. He was had a really hard time pleasing himself with his solos. Very particular. But I'm like, John, that's it. It's not going to get better than that. You know, and I wasn't just saying that because I didn't want him to do additional takes. I'm like, dude, this is the take.
Now you can have a silent digital tyranny. Just record them all and like, no, I'm going to use number three. It's fine.
That might happen.
Yeah, both of you are soloing, because I noticed the two solos in this, the one that I was just referring to at about 2 minutes in, and then the one toward the end of the song, are totally different sounds. So I'm guessing one of them is him and one of them is you. Let me play a little bit of the first one. So that giant, thick Neil Young-y sort of sound, there's that one. Is that John, do you think?
That's totally John.
All right. And then the one at the end of the song.
That's also John, as a matter of fact.
Now that I'm playing it, it might be a different tone, a different patch, but it's obviously the same style. He's blazing in a way that I'm guessing, we'll see if we actually stumble any of your solos and the discussion here so we can go through those. Let's talk about the end of the song. I mean, the song itself is almost 5 minutes long. You managed to stretch out the end quite a bit, and some of it is just repeating that Pale Blonde Hell, and then you do some vocal acrobatics with that, just more jamming on the guitar. Once you're on this blazing minor key thing, you could go on for 10 minutes if you wanted. Did you record the four of you when you're actually putting this recording together? Would you all play live so you can kind of decide how long it's going to go and then do the overdubbing? Or was it more, we're just doing drums, we already know how long it is, and we'll figure out how to fill the space?
That record, probably other than John's guitar solo, it's all live. My track is live. Bass and drums are live. There might have been maybe a fixer overdub here or there, but otherwise, that is all completely live.
Instrumentally live or even the vocals?
Instrumentally.
That's always dangerous anyway. You don't want to have all that bleed in the...
That's right. That rarely happens. I'm sure I had a scratch track, but it's very rare. I mean, for me, because I'm concentrating on sort of keeping the song on the rails and I don't always get the best vocal takes during my scratch tracks. Although some people swear by it. They're like, nope, that's the only way I'm going to do it. Live vocals. But you really got to also set up for it engineering-wise that you can get the, quote, cleanest vocal take as possible.
Well, if you're playing electric, at least you can put the damn amp in the other room and have a complete separation. If you're playing acoustic, you're just, there's no good way to do it and be able to replace stuff later or...
Yeah, you got to commit to it. It's a commitment.
Sure. I had forgotten about Six String Soapbox, which I guess is half an album. So this is several years into this band, and it had been basically the same lineup. That this is a band that was very comfortable with itself by 93, 94 when you're recording this.
Absolutely, yeah.
When this existed, how much of your career was it? Like, was it this was the thing that you were trying to push forward and make yourself a career, a full rock star, or were you still playing as a backup person to other people, like fully half your time?
At this point, I was definitely pursuing this 100%. In terms of a career, that implies that I was making money or going to make money with this. And you know where I'm going with this?
That's always a question. I'm always curious. Was this working a day job while you're doing this and the studio work, or is the studio work sort of paying the bills and then this is the passion project?
Yeah, this is definitely my passion. I wanted it to happen. At that time, the first I signed to Heyday Records in San Francisco for the first two records. How'd that go? And then they got picked up by Normal Records in Germany. And for Pale Blonde Hell, I signed directly to Normal. So then I didn't have a U.S. label, which was okay because I didn't have a lot of success in the U.S. anyway. It was a bit of a Sisyphean task. So I started having much more success in what they call the gas territories in Europe, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. I had a really great booking agent, the best agent in Germany, which is where I coincidentally had the most success. That record, Pale Blonde Hell, sold like 10,000 units, which is the most I've sold of any of my solo records. That was mostly in Germany. So it was definitely my biggest success. And it kind of got my foot in the door for later, mostly for tours. I never had, again, that degree of success in terms of album sales.
Well, let's talk transition then. Less than 3 years after this, you're recording Anonymous, which came out in 1997, your solo record. So you broke up Junkyard Love. Was this a geographical movement or what was driving this?
This is actually pretty easy. This is an easy one. In 94, on that Pale Blonde Hell tour, I met a woman in Germany who is my wife now, who I've been with since 94. I didn't move to Germany until 2001. So after Pale Blonde Hell, then we recorded Dwarf Star. That's the acoustic record. And then we did one more rock record, which was New Improved Pain. And by the time I was writing songs for New Improved Pain, I felt like I was writing songs specifically for this band, Junkyard Love. I felt like I kind of put myself in a corner. I felt like I was writing songs for the wrong reasons. And at that point, I realized that there might have been another way to go. Maybe I didn't have to break up that band, but it's what I chose to do. And after I did that, that's when I started writing songs for Anonymous, which is clearly much different than anything I did with Junkyard Love.
Interest. Well, I twisted logic. Would straighten me right out. It hit me with a hammer. You almost knocked me out. So don't do me any favors. They're not the kind I need. Don't do me no fucking favors. Do me no favors, please.
So this is basically the finale of the record. There's a little tidbit after it, but the big song, and it's quite underproduced. It's very deliberate. It's a simple chord progression, but it also has some of those open strings to add some extra little chromatic bits in it. And the main, most interesting melodic chordal thing that happens is at the end of every, mostly just in, what, F sharp major, and then you're going up to, it's a G sharp seventh at the end of every. It's unbeknownst to me that it's kind of this question mark sort of gesture. If you're normally, if you stayed in the key, it would be a G sharp minor or something, but you're hitting the major right there and a seventh as well. So it has this nice, interesting, dramatic gesture. And then that's enough material there between that and the chorus. It lasts quite a long time. This is another almost 5 minute thing. There's basically no solos in it. There's a little bit of organ, a little bit of piano. They kind of do some things that sound like they could be solos, but they're not mixed high enough to be solos. It mostly is just focuses on keeping the lyric going and on the guitars.
That one I still play every now and then. I play with a friend of mine, a guy, an American guy who moved to my village, and his guitar player. And we do some duo stuff now and then. In fact, I'll be releasing a show we recorded together in Italy a couple of few years ago. He really wanted to play that song. I said, yeah, well, let's do it. So, but then I had to relearn it. And it was kind of tricky. It's a lot of these songs, if I hadn't played them for a while, I can't freaking remember how I played the song. Because with this open tuning, maybe sometimes, so I always got the drop D, but then did I tune the B to a C? I can't remember. Was I playing with a capo? All these things. And I got to really sit down and play with the song till I can figure the bloody thing out. Or where did I put my finger? Where's that note coming from? I can't even figure it out. So it's kind of fun. It's a fun challenge to revisit these songs. At that time, I was listening to, I probably not that long ago had discovered Sparkle Horse, and his music really blew me away. And I thought, oh, this is the kind of music I want to make. I loved how organic it was, how sparse, how slow, how atmospheric, and just how intense. It sounded very intimate. It sounds like you're right, almost inside his head. It seems like he took the shortest distance from the heart to the head to the recording device. And that's something that I wanted to achieve. That really inspired me. And I think Anonymous was my first attempt to do something like that.
And I think like Sparkle Horse, as you went on, you got kind of more and more atmospherics, more and more little tricky electronics and things just to spice up the palette. Whereas this is, well, this song in particular, not necessarily the whole album, but when you're trying to play authentically, it kind of can feel wrong to do little tricks. Although by the time we get to the third song that we're going to hear from Bumbling Home from the Star, just 4 years later, it seems much more produced. You had Linda Pittman playing drums, Mickey Borens playing bass. Again, was this kind of you and those two doing the main thing and then you doing all the overdubs yourself? Or were you engineering this yourself? I couldn't tell with this one.
Steven was there producing, Mikey Borens, the bass player, and Linda, they just kind of fell into the songs. I sent a demo tape to Steve Wynn. It was just me sitting on my couch in Long Beach playing these songs on an acoustic guitar into a Walkman. He tells me that that's actually what we should release. I guess I sent him my only copy. I hope he still has it. He's like, he said he was kind of blown away when he heard it. And it's clearly the beginning of a new era for me. In terms of the sparseness of the song, to this day, I always want to do what is in the best interest of the song. I try to let the song dictate that, or to be present enough that the song will let me know what it needs or what it doesn't need. And it's better, I think, to default to less, although it's not always my credo or it's not always my approach. I sometimes like to overdo it. I like to overproduce. I like layers and layers of tracks as well. But sometimes the song says, hey, you know, this is enough. I don't need any more. So let's leave it at that.
We haven't talked about your lyrical approach here. You know, in a song that's this slow, the lyrics are really important. There's a kind of nice mixture of tones here between, you think what's in my best interest is unbeknownst to me. You know, I'm going to use the word unbeknownst to be a little, but then don't do me no fucking favors, you know, comes pretty soon after that, that it's kind of playing with this elegant or crude am I going to be from moment to moment. As kind of a way for me of tracking, it's a slow burn song. It's not an angry song, but it's definitely bitter. And so bitterness kind of comes in little sparks. So yeah, even the places where I was saying, like, it sounds like it should be a solo break. You finish your first chorus. Well, you have piano comes in, but it's mostly just the guitar is hitting a little harder. And that's what carries it through. Like, it doesn't speed up. You could easily put a lead guitar, and evidently you play that, you know, could have put your Neil Young sound on and made some feedback noises or something. But no, just the slow power here.
I got certain songs that I call brooders, you know, they brood like in that certain Neil Young brooding way. This is maybe more of a seether. You know, it sees, there's definitely venom in it. It's got some vitriol. It's subdued anger. I don't know how to describe it, but it's definitely one of those songs that's got at least one middle finger up in the air.
So when you write lyrics like this, and in this, there's so many little variations from chorus to chorus, from line to line within the chorus of how you're going to say, don't do me any favors. Don't do me no, are you going to use the double negative? Are you going to switch back to just the, you got to do all the variations. So how much of this kind of comes out? Are you ever writing these things on a bus, or is it always the guitar is next to you and that's how you're writing the lyrics? And so they're crafted to fit that particular structure that you've written out, or is it, I've written the first verse and the chorus, and then a long time later, then more of it comes?
Well, first of all, the music always came first for me, like to the higher percentile. And then I would try and find a melody. As I'm finding the melody, even before I find words, I'm already looking for the phrasing or discovering the phrasing within this chord progression and within this melody. And then slowly some lyrics will appear or develop. And it often, I kind of need my space. I need time. I need nothing else to be going on, which is maybe why it's been more difficult to write songs in the last years, because I feel like I don't, but maybe I'm kidding myself, because I do have time to myself, but I just haven't gotten back to my songwriting, which is another story, which we may or may not explore here. I kind of need the space, and it's this kind of process where I'll think about it constantly for hours on end, and then write some stuff down, and then revisit it. Okay, is this good? Does that stay? Does this go? Even something like that phrasing, that was probably where I was like, oh, let's see if we can change it up a little bit. Do me no favors. Don't do me any favors. Do me no effing favors. Yeah.
And when you're coming up with these lyrics, like, are you letting the song invent a story for you? Or are you channeling, like, so is this a real message to a real person? Or would it necessarily always be, even if it's reaching back in your memory somewhere? Or are you kind of just letting the song invent a character?
That was the case with Pale Blonde Hell. That was a fictional character. Whereas this one, this has a pretty specific recipient. So this one was pretty easy because, yeah, I knew exactly who I was writing it for, so to say, or who inspired it. So this is more black and white, whereas Pale Blonde Hell was a little bit more fantasy.
All right, well, I'm not going to ask you to reveal the story here, but is this a work situation? Because it sort of sounds like it's, you know, somebody trying to micromanage your time and make you write in a certain way or something like that. Or is this a more, just the fact that I can't tell if you're talking like about a band member or a family member or something.
This is a relationship.
Okay.
And then, yeah, it's complicated. So then it was kind of like I was in this relationship, and then I met another woman, this woman in Germany, but oops, I still had this other relationship. So then there was this whole drawn out sort of torturous breakup thing going on with a lot of unnecessary aspects where the person I was with in this other relationship was going to some real extremes. I think her intention was to try to keep me in the relationship, but it completely backfired. So that's kind of where this specifically, where I'm like, don't do me any favors. And in the end, you're not doing either of us any favors.
It's good to get that much of the story because it plays on with how you write this kind of thing. That sometimes if I write an emotion song like that, well, I purposefully will just, it has to be just set down in one burst. Because otherwise, my self-reflection will kick in and it'll be too complicated. It'll be too self-deprecating. I couldn't just write a fuck you song. It would have to be, oh, but it's probably partially my fault. Like, get into the, like, seeing it objectively and constructively. Like, but for a song, you probably want to just purposefully take only a part of what you're feeling, you know, that even if you write it over a period of days and are tweaking the lyrics, you want to get what you felt for that second and put that out there, the honest seething. So that honesty actually ends up really not being an honest reflection you know, unless you're actually just walking around in a funk for days seething like this, which certainly I can also sympathize with.
No, that's a very good point. In fact, I did talk about the process taking days at times, but I can't remember if that was specifically the case with this song. It's more likely that this one came out all at once.
It's many years. Let's get to the third song, getting more and more recent as we go. So from Bumbling Home from the Star 2002, the song off of that I had picked, Don't Think Twice. Get us up to date here, well, up to 2002. Before we hear it, say a little bit about, so this is a new band you had put together, Ed Campworth, Brandon Laws, Jesse Wilder. This is the second track on the album after a Mott the Hoople cover of all things. And then this is the thing that hits you. So it struck me as like where the single goes in the album order. You know, it's always song two or song three. And this seemed a very interesting arrangement. Do you want to say something about it before folks hear it?
I was living in LA. We were talking earlier. You mentioned briefly something about a day job. My day job was working in the film industry in production and then later in the art department. Then I had recently moved from Los Angeles to Long Beach, California. I went into a now very popular record store, Fingerprints, where they do a lot of in-stores now these days. Actually, they were doing them back then too, but it's really become quite a thing for them in Long Beach. And I walk in and I guess I was buying something or I was looking around and I went to the cash register and there's a guy there, a younger guy, and he said, "Hey, aren't you Chris Kakavas?" I said, "Yeah." He introduced himself as Ed Campworth. He said, "I'm a bass player, and if you want to jam, just let me know. So here's my phone number." So I called him, and basically Ed Campworth put my band together. Next thing, he's like, "Okay, I know a drummer. Cool. So now I got a drummer and a bass player." And then Ed's like, "Hey, I know this guy. He plays keyboards and guitar, and he can sing really well." So that was Jesse Wilder. So that's how I ended up with this band, one of my favorite bands, I got to say, who I later called the Slivers of Hope. And they're my Long Beach boys. And we made this really great record called Bumbling Home from the Star.
And are they all 10, 20 years younger than you?
Yeah. They're all younger. And I'm like, wow, okay, cool.
Bad boy,
So a much more developed arrangement. You know, it's got actual synth in it, and an interesting way that, you know, the synth part is, in fact, is at the beginning of the song. Yeah, tell me about this. You know, was this purely a studio invention, or was this something that was planned from the beginning where it starts actually something that sounds like distorted electronic drums? Maybe it's just the regular drums through some effects, but that you've got this interesting fade in with the synth doing the guitar riff and you're turning the tone up on the synth. And when you finally hit the lyrics, then it has this sound. Was this a producer thing? Was this a band arrangement thing?
I'm quite sure this fade-in was most likely the idea of Craig Schumacher of Calexico, Giant Sand fame. He also did three of Steve Wynn's records with Steve Wynn and the Miracle 3. Great engineer, great mixer, funny guy. So I brought him out from Arizona, from Tucson, to mix this record where we recorded it in Costa Mesa, California. And he had this effect. I think he used it on the beginning of Blackheart Procession from Calexico, where the drums are completely trashed out. And I love it. And he brought a lot of gear with him. And I think that might have been what we hear on the drums in the beginning. And this fade-in was very likely his idea. The synth actually came at the end. The synth was pretty much an afterthought, that much I remember.
You know, it's interesting how something that's that sort of last minute, after the fact, not an essential part of the song, ends up kind of defining the sound of the song. This is what makes this album and this song, you know, why this song jumped out at me on the album is because it just seemed like a clear departure from what you're doing at the Anonymous album.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So was it really just, you know, a change in engineering approach, or the song itself lyrically has a similar approach to the one that we just heard to Don't Do Me No Favors? Even the phrasing, it's not as slow, obviously, but Didn't Think You Cared, You're Never There. You know, it's the same kind of very segmented phrasing. Throw out a sentence, let you kind of live with it for a few seconds, throw out another one. It's not a rap. It's not a big stream of things. So it doesn't seem like your writing had changed in any fundamental way. Do you have any thoughts about sort of the particular writing approach to this song and how this might have been different than what had come before?
I have to say that band kind of inspired me. They also pushed me in a way because they were coming from so many places musically. The bass player was playing dub in some other bands. The drummer was playing this kind of crazy funk band. The keyboard player was playing his own pop stuff. And they were just in so many different genres of music. And the entire time I was also a fan to this day of so many genres of music. But I felt like they sort of gave me the permission or the freedom to explore and combine these genres without thinking about it too much. It's like, okay, oh, we're going to put synth on this. Okay, let's do that. On that song, It's All Over, the solo at the end, I'm playing the solo, and this was actually the engineer's idea, Mike McHugh. He brought this guitar out. I think it had 4, maybe 5 strings on it. It was a piece of junk. It was just trash. And he's like, okay, hold on. Because he also built microphones and he built amplifiers. So he pulled something out of his workshop, and it was like a little half-finished amplifier. It was tubes sticking out. It was just like a metal box with like tubes sticking out. And then he had a speaker just hanging from a wire, you know, about like a 2-foot wire. So he brings out this box and a speaker, and he puts it in the studio. He lays the speaker on the ground, and he says, okay, play your solo through this. I'm like, okay, well, let's see what happens. So, you know, trust me, we had enough guitars and amps to choose from, you know. So he's like, no, let's, you know, you got to do this. I'm like, okay. So I start playing, and I'm like, oh, my God, this tone is trash, you know. But all right, let's roll with it. So he rolled it. I'm trying to play a solo. I don't even know if the guitar was in tune. And I'm just kind of wanking on this thing. Oh, and I got really frustrated towards the end of it. And I just started like playing whatever. Well, it turns out that's the track that we kept for that song. So I love when spontaneous stuff happens like that. I was sure it was not going to be a keeper. They're like, you know, you got to hear that. You got to hear that. That's, you know, really good. And that whole session was kind of like the, where ideas are just being thrown out there from whoever. And we give it a try. Sometimes they'd work. Sometimes they wouldn't work. It was a very fun, experimental vibe on that record.
You can tell it's not simply in the engineering, just the percussion approach here. We can also talk about the solo at the same time, because this is leading into the solo. This is not the first time he's done very intrusive percussion playing here.
It's on the ride.
But it sounds like we brought a hubcap or, you know, one of those kind of just the use of it there. And he's got just in the main verses, the first two lines, basically you and guitar and bass, and then the lead guitar and this offbeat percussion thing comes in. Yeah, that we're going to do a cowbell or something.
I remember what happened. The drummer was very innovative, very experimental. I believe on that song, he put a cymbal on his floor tom. So that's that kind of muted thing that you're hearing in there, which sounds like a cowbell.
Uh-huh.
That's a cymbal sitting on his floor tom, though it's muted. And he came up with that really cool, like sort of syncopated beat. I'm just such a fan of his ideas. And again, that's the case where you put the song out there and the musicians that you trust bring such great ideas. That guitar line, that's from the guitar player. That was his idea. He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm like, cool, do that.
I was thinking, okay, that this is finally your solo style, but no, it's just basically one riff. And then he moves up and does it again, but then almost just like a lyric line. It doesn't sound like a solo. It sounds like it's a riff. You know, at the end of it, he does add a few extra notes to make it more solo-like, but then it kind of happens again a little later in the song, and it's pretty much exactly the same. Like, I'm sure it's not cut and pasted, but it sounds very intentionally like the solo keeps going a little bit. It's still not going to go crazy. It's not going to be what John Thoman was doing in the first song.
That's all the guitar player, Jesse Wilder. He's also playing a guitar riff, right, in the beginning? Or is that only the synthesizer? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
It seems like it's both, that it was guitar first, and then you're saying the synth was added over that. At a certain point in the song, the guitar starts it, and the synth takes it over, and it sounds like a continuous thing. It's a great little engineering trick.
That's his pop mentality, and I love it. It's like repetition, you know, find a little melody that works, and just, yeah, repeat it. I love it. I'm a big fan of that to this day. I love when things just repeat and recur, and... yeah, it's just a fun thing. And it's like, if you like it, well, let's do it again.
But yet, this is another one that this is only 4.5 minutes. It's not a 5-minute song. This could have been a 3-minute song. It's that snappy, but you do let it develop a little bit and it's not super fast. But then it actually does this kind of time change toward the end of the song. Let me play that. That we're going even more spacey, turn on the tremolo guitar, the drummer playing halftime, and it ends on this jazz chord, which is kind of out of nowhere. It's a really interesting little whimsical ending there, I guess.
I'm almost 100% sure that that was the bass player Ed Campworth's idea.
Mm-hmm.
He'd often just throw out odd suggestions. He's also the guy who suggested the trombone player for Bag in a Bottle.
It gives it a very nice jazzy you know, smooth jazz. And it's a very dark trombone sound.
Hey, that's my thing, baby. Smooth jazz. This song is a perfect example because it gave three examples of what each member brought individually to this song, idea-wise, musically. And I like to be open to that. I don't want to arrange with an iron fist, although I bring my arrangements in pretty concrete, I have to say. And in fact, you know, we got to throw Craig Schumacher in there too, you know. They all brought something to this arrangement, but shit, do I owe them a co-write now?
If they don't insist, it's simpler and it's not making any money anyway. This is a question that comes up pretty consistently of how you balance. You didn't put the band name on the album, that you made this a solo album, even though it was clearly a band and there were band decisions. That says a lot about the political situation, the way that you described it. Yeah, I got these session guys, or I roped in these famous guys that were playing around town that I always wanted to play with. No, it's a guy approached you. You know, it sets up a very definite power relation in terms of they appreciated your work and wanted to be part of this. And I guess it would still be an ethical question if it was making enough money. How do you cut everybody in? How do you, as a practical matter?
Yeah, yeah.
If it's a solo album, that means you're the one that actually was paying for the session time, right?
That's right, yeah.
You're not making them share the debt. Let's put it that way.
You know, and I can't remember if I paid them some nominal fee for recording. I try to treat them fairly. I think I would take in fact, in the end, on those last tours, I definitely went out of pocket because the guarantees just aren't what they used to be. And I ended up going out of pocket to make sure that they were paid, you know, not a lot, but hey, I had to give them something for doing it. Yeah, it's a tricky thing. And sometimes I think I might have unintentionally taken advantage, but it was more like an oversight rather than something intentional where I was like, oh shit, maybe I should have paid them X amount, or maybe I should have given this or that person credit. But it was more, if that happened, it was simply because I wasn't thinking about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, now suddenly I'm questioning myself, but I think for the most part, I don't think there was ever a time where somebody said, hey, I got this, we're going to bring this chorus to this thing, or that the arrangement is going to be so changed up that they would get a co-write. It's something, if that happened, that it was me just not understanding the dynamics of how that actually works.
Well, I just don't think there are standard rules. I think everybody, it's what people insist on at the time is what happens.
I think there is actually sort of a standard, because it's been happening for a long time in Nashville. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you got four guys sitting in a room writing a song together. You got two guys maybe, or maybe you got three guys. Who brings what? And at what point is it a co-write? I think probably at a certain level, there are very clear rules.
Well, I think it's just more whatever arrangement you agree on before you enter the situation. That, yeah, I was talking to a guy recently from Nashville that was saying, yeah, it is kind of standard there that, like, if you write in a room with some people, it's kind of understood that everybody's going to get the writing credit. Even if somebody does nothing, they were invited to the party, that's the way it's going to work.
Yeah. You just brought coffee, man. You brought coffee. No, that doesn't count.
Yeah, it just totally depends on how much money is actually involved and how egotistical, how possessive. A sort of a situation with a co-writer at some point where we are just feeling things out, just meeting for the first time, and he actually voiced something like that at the beginning, but it so didn't work. And then the thing that I put forward, I wanted to reuse myself. So yeah, I made sure that none of his contributions were in there, but I wasn't going to credit him. This is not an ongoing successful relationship that I needed to acknowledge.
I had a similar experience where a guy I was playing with in this band that I still play in, it's an improv band. And okay, it's an improv band. Just okay, keep this in mind.
Well, yeah, and looking at the way jazz, it's always credited to somebody, and probably it's just a standard. It's credited to somebody that's not even in the room, but yet if it's an improv situation, if it's a jazz situation, clearly everybody's contributing. You know, it would not be that song at all if it weren't these people. So there's on the other side of the Nashville thing where the musicians are doing one thing and the writer is doing something else, and the writer is sitting down at a piano and writing things on a staff. And those are just fundamentally different operations.
I'm like, dude, what are you even talking about? We don't play music until we get on stage. What co-write of what? And first of all, there's that aspect. Secondly, we ain't going to make a penny doing this. What are you trying to get a piece of? I'll give you 20% of nothing, but it's still nothing.
I want, when people look you up in whatever the database is, to see that my name is attached to you with a co-write. You know, that's what that sounds like, but...
Yeah, but, you know, four-way split, everybody's name's on it, then, or five-way at the time. But now we're a four-piece, you know.
You've brought up the present. Let's get close to the present. So we're going to just introduce the last song, I Won't Feel Well, from Love's Been Rediscontinued, 2013, your last solo album. It was that and 2008's Love's Been Discontinued. Those are your two Germany albums, or self-taught?
Well, self-taught was also recorded in Germany, but that was still with my boys, two of them from Long Beach, and then Jason Victor on guitar from New York, from Dream Syndicate, from Steve Wynn Miracle 3. That was recorded in Germany, but the two that we're talking about, Love's Been Discontinued, Love's Been Rediscontinued, those two were made with my German band, the trio, with Filippo Costanza on bass and Willy Wieland Roquel on drums.
And it's a brooder, but it's got some of that textural stuff that we heard in the last one, this going back and forth between a heavier guitar texture and more spacey keyboard heavy intro, very layered, spacey, deep chorus. You're double tracking your vocal, you're harmonizing the double tracking. You know, it's a very David Crosby-esque sort of thing that was at least suggesting itself to me. Yeah, do you want to say more about kind of where you've gotten to at least this point musically and then tell the rest of the story? This is 2013. This is still a while ago. You were talking about, you know, you're touring with Steve Wynn, you're doing this improv thing, not writing too many songs. So give us in 2 minutes or less the rest of the story, and then we can say a little more specifically about this song and we'll say goodbye.
So what I'll say briefly is I recorded that record, Love's Been Discontinued, in 2008. And at that time, I recorded about 23 songs. I picked the cream of the crop for Love's Been Discontinued, and we released that record. And some years later, I decided to revisit the outtakes. And when I re-listened to those outtakes, I thought, oh, I think there's another record here. So I went back into the studio in 2013. I finished those songs up. Most of them were pretty complete with overdubs. I think I had to sing a few. And what I'm really proud of, or what I'm really into about this record, is there are three tracks that are only the three-piece live. The song we're about to hear is not one of those, but there are three tracks, I believe, that are just the trio, and then I overdub my vocals. I'm really pleased with how this continuation of, or the re-release of these outtakes turned out. I think it's a really cool summary of that Love's Been Discontinued session.
I would not have guessed that this was the inferior crop of leftover songs. Like these,
yes.
It seemed a very gripping album to me.
Cool. Nice to hear. Thanks.
Any last words about this song in particular? I Won't Feel Well. I don't know why this is the second one on the album. Maybe I just didn't listen to the later parts of the album enough to get as sucked in, but this is one that kind of kicked me in the gut pretty quickly.
This is a song that developed after playing with these guys for a while. I have another song that never got recorded called This Place Is Dead. I think there's actually a video of a live performance of it with the band, with the trio. And it's kind of an exploration of this kind of chord progression, this kind of ascending, descending, a little bit circular chord pattern. And that's kind of where this song came from. Lyrically, I don't have much to say about this lyrically. It's just kind of is what it is. It's there when you hear the words of it speaks for itself. It tells its own story.
All right. Yeah, I guess before I let you go, so what are you working on now? Is there another one of these coming out eventually?
Unfortunately, in the last years, I kind of fell off the rails with my songwriting. I'll be honest, there was some depression involved, which may have come from the fact that I wasn't writing songs, or maybe because I fell into depression. I stopped writing songs. I'm doing better these days. Thank you very much. And I hope to eventually get back to writing songs. But these days, I'm more focused on being an official member of the Dream Syndicate. I was recently invited to be an official member. We recently recorded a new record in Richmond, Virginia. Been helping Steve out with some vocal ideas. Yeah, I'm just really excited to be a member of this band. And that's kind of where my focus is at these days. But I know that I got to start writing again. So it's a question of time. I got so far away from it, though, I'm not sure how to get back in, you know. I feel like I'm kind of climbing up onto the high dive right now. And when I get to the edge of that diving board, I just got to, you know, say jump. I got to figure out how to get back into the water.
So many of your songs sound so depressed in the first place, you know, Elliott Smith-wise. And of course, I'm just happy that you're still with us. There's too many. Depression is such a pervasive thing among singer-songwriter types, probably in the general population. But, you know, it can't be an accident that the particular life that one chooses in being a musician, you know, you would think that writing really depressing songs, it's a form of treatment. It's cheaper than therapy.
I agree. Yeah.
But it certainly doesn't fix things, as we have, you know, for example, after example, and Sparkle Horse is, of course, one of those. It's a balm, but it's not a permanent solution as a way of life. Maybe you can come up with an example of somebody that is writes a lot of depressing music, but like is just raring to go when you meet them and is just, you know, that's the way they channel those negative emotions and so that they can just be really on top of things. But yeah, so I think both being too depressed and actually being recovered from depression, neither of those is particularly inspiring necessarily for writing songs, especially if you don't have routine.
Well, my wife, she's like, so when are you going to write a happy song? I'm like, who the fuck wants to hear a happy song? I'm like, I don't want to hear a happy song. I want to, and also it's like, okay, you know, I don't want to be like the sad sack guy, you know what I mean? But I'm like, I'm going to sing about my life and I'm going to sing about the things that move me. Unfortunately, they're not always happy-go-lucky, you know. I sing about the things where the emotions stir me, because otherwise, for me, it's not authentic. So I try to find authenticity. Otherwise, whenever I try to write something for somebody about a certain theme or something, lyrically, it was always the worst crap ever, you know? I'm like, I can't do it. It's got to be real or it's not going to happen. Now, you know, you said, okay, show me the musician who's writing depressing songs, but is raring to go. I'm afraid I can't do that. Some of my favorites are Elliott Smith, Mark Linkous, and fucking Vic Chestnut. You know what I mean? So it's a pity that, you know, those guys are gone, you know? And
Nick Drake.
Oh, yeah, well, we're getting there.
The first one. With that, that's a good sentiment to send us into I Won't Feel Well. Thank you so much for your time. This is very, very illuminating.
Mark, thank you too, man. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks so much to Chris. Again, you can learn more about him at chris-kakavas.com. My next episode will be with Oregon singer-songwriter Lincoln Barr. He was in a band called Red Jacket Mine for many years and has just released his debut solo album last year. Very interesting guy, and you should know that I heard of him and decided to have him on the show because he became a supporter at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. And while this is definitely not a pay-for-play situation, you'll hear his music is great. If you want me to pay attention to what you do, showing that you support what we're doing here is a great way to do that. So even a small recurring donation would really help. The releases of this podcast are going to remain somewhat sporadic until we have a solid and continuous base of support. So please get in there, make your pledge if you want to hear more of these interviews. Now, I already have a lot of really good interviews scheduled for December and January, in addition to the 4 more already in the can interviews as of right now. You can get all those at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com when they come out. The other thing I've been very excited about, my new album, which is called Mark Lint's Dry Folk, will be out, it looks like, within the next week. So I will put up a post at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com about that when it comes out. But the fastest way, the most reliable way to get news on what I am doing songwriting-wise is to, again, pledge a small per-product amount at patreon.com/marklint. A little bit of support there will go a long way to telling me that somebody actually cares if I complete more songs. So I am very stoked about this whole release thing and thinking about what to do for a year-end special episode, either with that or bringing back some old
NEM guests or some combination of those. We'll see. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer signing off.